Okay. You don't know how fortunate you are to live in Arizona. Arizona has one of the very best state agencies, like the Center for Arizona Policy. That's probably the best one of all 50 states. Number two, you have the Alliance Defense Fund, which is a profound organization doing absolutely wonderful things. You probably have 12 to 20 of the best churches in America. Most cities in America would give their eye teeth to have even one church like a Scottsdale Bible, much less 10 or 12 or 15. And so he kept naming all the things to be thankful for in Arizona and in Phoenix, and it was really great. And then he says, last but not least, most people's brains are in their heads. But there's one person in Phoenix that he's got brains that start in his toes and go up his leg and go all the way to his head and back down again. What's he talking about? Then he said, I'm so thankful that this man preceded me to Harvard, because this man read all 17 million copies of the Harvard Library, which meant when I got there, I wouldn't have to. And then he says, Dr. Wayne Grudem is a gem, is an absolute gem. And so, my goodness, goodness, imagine someone saying that. And so it was a beautiful comment about Dr. Wayne Grudem at the CAP dinner the other night. I don't know why I hang around a guy like a Wayne. Cambridge, Harvard, Oxford, Colorado, Montana State. So I don't get it. I don't get it. How can one help but be pleased? How can one help but believe that maybe a tide has turned? Maybe. Far, far from it, long ways to go, but at least the first signs of the tide turning. And sometimes the tide has to go out before you can see who it is that is swimming naked. And so there's all kinds of positive things about a tide turning. A few weeks ago, I'm standing in this class, and so this is just 30-second review of this book, that the political means and the market means. That doesn't mean that even when you go the political means, communism, socialism, Keynesianism, that there still isn't a little bit of market in all of that. And that doesn't mean that if you go strictly the market means, that there's not a little bit of politics in all of that. Because politics is just the way we organize to govern ourselves. All I'm saying in this book is that the market means was intended by the founding fathers to keep the political means very, very small. Limited government. Less government over here. That is the market means. On the other hand, the political means is, you know what? I can't get the people to do it because the people are way too stupid, so we will force it on them. We will force communism on them. We will force socialism on them. We will eliminate private ownership on them, or in context of our life, or we will force government health care on them. They would never vote for it, the market means, to do that by themselves, but we can surely. And we have to do that because we are smarter, we know more than does the common man, who are kind of semi-idiots, so they need us. You heard me say the other day that when you take the political means, when you choose to do it that way, they view the economy as a machine that has buttons to pull and levers and clutches to get on top of, and you just need smart people. people to do that. I mean, you have to be every bit as smart as Larry Summers, president of Harvard University, to be able to know how to run that machine. You and I wouldn't get it. We who believe in the market means say, no, government, just get out of the way, and you'll be just totally amazed at what entrepreneurs do. Government, just get out of the way with regulation, get out of the way with taxes, get out of the way with interference, and you can't believe how people with IQs of 80 and 90 and 100 and 110 and 120 and 130 and 140 and 150 and 160, it's just amazing how that all comes together. So I tried to put it this way the other day when I was talking about the market means. I said, you know, the market means is just simply a bathroom scale. You get on, you look what it says, and it is what it is. The market is, gravity is, leaves are green, the sun comes up in the east. You don't have to design the market, manage the market, plan the market, create the market. The market just happens. Thousands and millions and billions of people coming together, interacting with their brains and their enlightened self-interest, supply and demand determining price, price telling us what to do. Supply and demand determining wages, wage rates tell us what to do, etc. Profits, losses. Profits are wonderful. They give us a signal we're doing something right. Costs are wonderful. If your costs exceed your profits, that's a signal. Something isn't quite right here. So it's a wonderful signaling system. Yeah, the market is a marvelous instrument of communication to tell me what I weigh. The market is a stupendous transmitter of opinions. Whose opinions? All of your opinions. It's a tremendous transmitter of opinions. Now, it's one thing to just transmit opinions. To determine value. Oh, I see. So it is the seventh wonder of the world, if there ever was one. Because you don't design it, manage it, create it, get out of the way. And the founding fathers deeply, deeply understood limited government. That's what the whole revolution was about, was to create some exceptionalism by limiting government, because when you limit government, you open up a space for freedom. And when you open up a space for freedom, guess what comes in and fills that space? I'm looking at it. Builders, creators, dreamers, doers, entrepreneurs, inventors. Got it? See, that's what fills that space. And that has worked so well that with less than 4% of the world's population, we annually produce almost one-third of the world's wealth. With just a few little percent of the population of the world, we produce 80% of the world's Nobel laureates. With just a few people, you look at the 10 greatest hospitals in the world, and 8 of the 10 are in the United States. If you look at the greatest universities of the world and stack them up and say there's the 50 greatest, 40 out of the 50 are in the United States. You call that American exceptionalism. Unless you have a president who doesn't care and doesn't believe in American exceptionalism and he wants no part of that nonsense, and therefore you don't let the people know. So look at. We as Americans do not have to toot our horn, do not have to tell on a mountaintop how wonderful America is. We don't have to do that. It'll speak for itself. But don't you think that maybe the president could talk about when 33 miners are saved out of a deep 2,000-foot mine and are buried for over 60 days, do you think maybe the president should say, I'm so proud of America today, because I got to tell you that those 33 miners will never have been saved had it not been for American capitalism, had it not been for a miner in Pennsylvania who invented a drill bit that does da-da-da-da-da-da, and who da-da-da-da-da-da. And so about a dozen of the main aspects of going down and getting these 33 guys out of the ground and bringing them up had everything to do with American exceptionalism. And so I don't want to brag, but in front of Americans, I can say, I'm so proud of you. I'm so proud of this country that we're able to do that. How neat it would be to say, you know, the tsunami hit Indonesia, and in comes the American carrier, and this carrier has 2 15-megawatt generating plants generating fresh water by the millions and millions of gallons. The interesting thing about a tsunami is people need fresh water. About a tsunami, they need some shelter. A tsunami, they need some food. And this carrier, everything is operating off of this carrier. If you'd see the picture of this, I mean, maybe 50 helicopters landing at the same time, coming in, flying out, coming in, flying out. Oh my goodness. It's just like manna from heaven to have this carrier be in the same vicinity of the tsunami. It was scheduled to be up in Korea, in the Korean Sea, and just good fortune that it was there. And I'll tell you, there's millions of people that are alive today because of an American carrier that can do these sorts of things with food, water, health care, generate electricity. And so, you know what my heart is? Yes, good for America. Good for America. American exceptionalism really is quite wonderful. So, today, we're going to talk about the election and then the election's impact on the economy. Let's start with just a couple of basics of the election. As you know, we didn't win the Senate, but we have 6 more net-net basis in the Senate than we did before. So we've got that Senate getting closer and closer to 50-50. Perhaps it's very good that we did not win the Senate, because at the end of the day, then, to blame everything that happens now in America on the Congress and not blame it on the Senate or blame it on the President is a big stretch. If you'd have won both the House and the Senate, I think it's easier to triangulate. So I'm just saying maybe it's good that we didn't quite get enough votes to win the Senate. If we could have won Delaware, and if we could have been won California, that would have been a net-net, that would have been a dramatic, but it didn't happen. Okay. Now, the negative of not getting the Senate is any Supreme Court nominee in the future has to be nominated by the Senate and okayed by the Senate. It has very little to do with the House. The problem here is Justice Scalia or Justice Thomas or Kennedy, if they would happen to die in the next 2 years, we are in big, big trouble. So that's the negative, that one of those dudes don't die. The next one scheduled to go off is Ginsburg, and it would just be a net-net no difference. We take off a strong liberal, we put on a strong liberal. But if one of the conservatives would go down in the next year, so that's the one real negative thing about not picking up the Senate. But in the House, as you all know, we made about a net-net 60 people change. That's huge. We picked up 6 new senators. So that evened out. We picked up 6 new governors, which evens it out. And let me explain state. Look, except for Nebraska, each state has both a Senate and a House. Each state government does. Nebraska is unicameral, so it doesn't. So by and large, we're talking about 100 houses then. For the United States, 100 houses. Prior to this election, 60... with Democrats having the majority vote, and 40 Republicans having the majority vote. After the election, it just switched. And now it's 60 houses that have a strong Republican vote and 40 Democrats. So it just switched on us in that election. Why is that kind of important? Because all the boundaries are going to be redrawn for the census, and it's sure nice to have lots of Republican governors and people who will help maybe in the redistricting here, but we'll just see how that all comes out. As Christians, we have to be absolutely delighted that we went from a Speaker of the House that is probably one of the number one abortion advocates in the United States to now having a Speaker in the House, John Boehner, who is as pro-life as any Speaker of the House since Roe v. Wade. So for the last 40, 50 years, John Boehner from Cincinnati, he's a good man in this sense. John has some weaknesses, but who doesn't? So I think he's going to be a good Speaker of the House. And it's even more powerful than that. The House has picked up four doctors who are all right to life. And when you have an MD degree, you speak with some authority when it comes to life and death. So we probably have the most pro-life Congress that we've had in a long, long time. Now, I'm sharing now just the good news. I'm not saying you should clap. I'm not saying you should be elated. I'm not saying you should be cocky. I'm just trying to call this now the way it is, and now the work begins. The real work begins. We in this election, we have the state of Iowa saying to three judges who you never kick out of their jobs, you say to these three judges, no, you jerry-rigged the system. You said that the Iowa Constitution says something that it does not say, so that you have marriage does not have to be man-wife. Marriage could be woman-woman, man-man. And Iowa has had that law, and they kicked those three. They eliminated those three judges. They voted them out. This doesn't happen hardly ever. There's some real negative to this side, but on this issue, no kidding, Lone Ranger. So it just didn't hurt my heart at all that those three judges are going to have to now sit down and go back and become attorneys. The only problem with them going back in attorneys is right now in America, we have more attorneys than we have people. So we have to be very careful with that. So that's kind of the thing on the election. It has switched dramatically to the side of people who want market solutions rather than political solutions. The only way you will pull off the atrocity of cap and trade is to have a Congress and a Senate and a president who will sign it that says, we will have cap and trade. The market wouldn't touch that with a 10-foot pole. Thank goodness we can breathe a little bit easier that we're not going to have cap and trade foisted on us. When it comes to the health care, that also was foisted on us, and now the only thing we can do is two things in the next 2 years. Unfund part of it, don't fund part of it, and then in 2 years from now, repeal the whole darn thing. So this is a 2 year process now of unfunding. For example, the healthcare bill calls for 16,000 new IRS agents to watch all of this stuff, and Congress can just simply say, we're not going to fund the salary of 16,000 new IRS. So that's what I mean by defunding it. The 1099, where everybody, anything that buys something from you for over $600, then you have to file it with the federal government, and that goes through the tax bill. Well, small businesses said, this is going to drive us nuts. This is going to cost unbelievable billions. So we can probably get that repealed. So there will be some things that we can repeal. There will be some things that we can be unfunded. But the bigger issue is this. This whole catastrophic mess where all 1,300 pages of this health care bill have at least three unintended consequences per page. Three unintended consequences per page. So one of the unintended consequences is that this new health bill is going to cost Caterpillar $100 million. Well, as if Caterpillar wants to sit around and say, oh, nice. Very nice. We're already providing all this health care for our people, and now this is going to cost us 100. So Caterpillar naturally does a pushback on this. McDonald's has 3,000 people that, or 30,000, excuse me, 30,000 people who work for McDonald's that all have nice insurance policies. Not Cadillac health care insurance policies, but nice policies. And McDonald's looks at an unintended consequence and says, okay, government, if that's what you want, we're going to dump them all on you right now. Take them. Take them. You insure them. You take care of them. And government says, oh, whoa. I don't know if I can do this. Why would government put on that 1099? Government's just seeking revenue. That's why. With 16,000 more IRS agents, let's see where we can get more revenue. More taxes. That's what the political model always believes in. Taxes, government. Because government is all wise. Government is all wisdom. Only they are smart enough to know how it all works. And so they look with great disdain at people who make up the market side. Because they're stupid. They cling to their religion. They cling to their racist to the core, blah, blah, blah. So that's what you have happening all the time. So you defund and then eventually repeal. But we have to have a change in the presidency to repeal. Are there just absolute terrific ideas in the meantime? Of course there's terrific ideas in the meantime. 40 million, by the way, I'm going to talk, and then I'm going to stop here a little bit, and then we're going to do Q&A, and then you get to ask what you want to ask, instead of I talk about what I want to talk about. So I'm just warning you, that's where we're going to go here. But with 40 million people that are uninsured, that's what brought this whole healthcare thing to a boil. Oh my gosh. We've got 40 million Americans that are uninsured. Well, an economist would look at that 40 million and say one of the main reasons that we have 40 million uninsured, and by the way, these are mainly people in their 20s and 30s who are betting on fairly good health and therefore betting that maybe I can get by without insurance. That's a good part of the 40 million. But anyway, an economist would say one of the main reasons you have 40 million is because healthcare insurance costs are so high. And by definition, when the costs are so high and they're up so far, people are unwilling to buy insurance. Why are insurance costs so high? Well, first of all, you do know, do you not, that insurance companies cannot sell insurance across state lines. So health insurance really becomes a state matter. And now the state says, I will provide some insurance for you. And everybody and his dog comes and says, this has got to be part of the package. In vitro fertilization has to be part of the package. For balding men, that problem has to be part of the package. Hangnails, that. So the point here is, now, those are all called, on top of the basic insurance package, that is called state mandates. So you come to a state like New Jersey, New York, or California, and you have anywhere from 125 to 175 state mandates on health care. And it, with every mandate, up goes the costs. Up goes the insurance with every mandate. Well, it's Cadillac and Mercedes-Benz health care for everybody. That's like legislating that no one again now gets to eat a McDonald's hamburger. We all have to go to Paradise Valley Country Club, and we all have to eat a $24.95 hamburger. There are no $1.90. That's what those mandates all do. So what do those mandates do? The ones that have insurance costs, the same. Okay, the states that have the least mandates, Iowa and Idaho. Iowa and Idaho each have 16 state mandates. Some of these other states have 75, 100, 150 mandates. But those states that have all those mandates, health insurance, roughly speaking, is 3 to 4 times more costly than in the state of Idaho than in the state of Iowa. So now here's the point. If we can sell insurance across state lines, you automatically null and void all those state mandates and you start from scratch. And that's good. That's what we want to do. We want to start from scratch. And now we once again will have everybody and his dog lobbying the state government, but no, this has got to be part of the mandate. This has got to be part of the health care, et cetera. I wonder where that came from. I know I didn't touch it. So that would be a marvelous first step, selling insurance across state lines. Texas has some serious tort reform in place. That is, just because you lose a little finger in an accident, a jury is not going to award you $50 million. Now, admittedly, you lose your little finger, it is a loss, no question about it. And there's got to be some monetary. But a trial juries have just figured out they can just give any, they go right for the deep pocket. So if it happens to be that you lost it in a McDonald's, well, McDonald's rich, let's smack them about $50 million for that. And then, of course, attorney fees are about 30% of that. So what the heck? Why do they bury economists and attorneys 30 feet under the ground? Because down deep, they're really good people. So tort reform in Texas has brought a lot of OBGYN doctors back into practice, has reached out, and a lot of people getting back into the medical profession because insurance costs have become so incredibly high because you can be sued for everything. If you're a doctor, you're stupid not to order Tamiflu MRIs because you just are covering yourself in every direction. And with some tort reform, it's going to give way more freedom to practice medicine. Well, we can learn that from Texas. There's something else that we can learn from Texas. If you really want to now start cutting government spending, you can do as Texas did. Texas has said, listen, we are not going to spend more than 16% of the Texas GDP on government and government employees. 16 or 17%, that's the limit. We're not going to go over that. Whereas other states that don't have that law, you've got California right now spending 27% of its state GDP on government and government regulations and government employment. So in some ways, almost double. Are any of you surprised that half of all the jobs that have been created in the last 2 years have been created in Texas? Are any of you surprised that Nebraska is sucking water? They're in big, big trouble. Now, here's the good news for Arizona. This is a unique opportunity for Arizona just simply to advertise from the bottom of California to the top. Come to Arizona. Come to Arizona. But if they're going to come to Arizona, there's a number of things that we've got to do to get our acts together so that we really are attractive to move from California to move to Arizona. But see, that's what I want to talk about. That's not necessarily what you want to talk about. So Barry, come on, push on. So lastly, and we can talk about any of these things deeper if you want to. Lastly, and not really last, is we in our healthcare system must move to health savings accounts. Instead of I go to work for you, and you buy me all the health care I need for my family, you give me a card, and now I go into the medical marketplace and buy all the health care I need, and I charge it to the card, charge it to you, charge it to the employer, charge it to the third-party payer, charge it to Medicare, charge it to Medicaid, charge it to anybody but me. Yes, I'm using it. This is my health care, my family. Just don't charge me for it. So what we have done in this country is 5 out of every $6 spent in healthcare do not come from our own pocket. 5 out of every $6 come from a third-party payer, employer, insurance company, Medicare, Medicaid, blah, blah, blah. Stop. In other words, the way we practice medicine in America is like going shopping with someone else's credit card. Now, I got to tell you, when I say the market means, when you allow someone to shop with someone else's credit card, it messes everything up. Trust me. You're not sensitive to price at all. Someone else is paying for it. Who cares? So how could we get to this point in American history where 99 out of 100 people don't know the cost of an MRI, but everybody knows the cost of a gallon of gasoline? They don't care about an MRI, the cost. I'm not paying for it. Got me? And so we not only don't have tort reform, but we have an incentive system that says, go for the Cadillac. It's not going to cost you anything anyway. Someone else is going to pay. Ladies and gentlemen, that day has got to come to an end. We must go to a competitivized healthcare system where we have health savings accounts, where I go to work for you. You and I buy me a high deductible catastrophic. In other words, we want all Americans protected from a heart attack, cancer, high-end medical care bill. We have to be protected from that. We do that with a high deductible catastrophic. So that if I have a heart attack, Mandy's protected. Mandy gets cancer. So we have a high deductible catastrophic. Then, though, for every medical bill that's $3,000 and lower, we begin to fund a Barry Asma's health savings account, and now I pull money out of my HSAs to pay for that. Just like I have to pull money out of my pocket to buy a gallon of gasoline, have a repair on my car, blah, 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 blah. We've got to somehow, some way, get health care back to where we have some price sensitivity. And if someone else is going to pay for it all, there's never going to be price sensitivity, i.e., there's never going to be a control on costs, i.e., costs are going to go on forever. But when there is competition, precisely why I can go into a Burger King, have a nice Whopper burger for $1.59. I mean, a nice beef patty, sesame seed bun, a tomato, a nice slice of onion on there for $1.59. Oh, Burger King, why are you only charging $1.59? You should charge $19.99. No, the problem is the minute we charge $19.99, we're done. We're finished. See, there's competition. There's competition in fast, and so the price breaks are very, very thin. You could just say, well, let's just levy a 10 cents a slice or even 1 penny a slice on pizza. And a guy that runs a big pizza firm would say, well, that's enough to break me. That's enough to break my back. So excuse me. So health savings accounts to competitivize the healthcare system. Makes lots of sense. And there's a bunch of other things that we can do in healthcare till we reach the point that we can have the whole darn healthcare bill repealed. We're going to unfund a bunch of it in the next 2 years, and 2 years from now, we're going to repeal the whole nine yards. Once again, though, does this fit everybody's mode, even in an audience like this? No, it does not. No. In any audience of this size, at least 15-20% feel more comfortable with the political solution than with the market solution. I was that way for a good part of my early life. I get out of college with 3 degrees in economics, and I believe fully in Keynesian economics. I was a full-bore socialist. I was so into socialism that I took a whole summer after my doctorate program to translate Karl Marx's Das Kapital from the German to the English. My mom helped me. She knew how to speak German and some Russian. And so mom came out and spent 3 months at Mandy and I's house as she's helping me translate Das Kapital from the German to the English. Why are you doing this? Because it's the same reason why Wayne Grudem studies Hebrew and studies Greek. Does anyone want to pay that price? Do any of you want to go back to the Cambridge Library and drop your face into a Hebrew book or a Greek book and study day after day, month after month, year after year? Does anybody want to do that? Or are you pretty content to let Wayne do that, and he'll kind of share the essence of this darn thing? Well, my feeling is on socialism, I wanted to get to the nub of the matter. I really, really wanted even the small nuances of Karl Marx and Das Kapital. And so I know how this feels. I became a socialist because the rhetoric is so wonderful. Now, understand something. I'm a Christian teaching a Sunday school class at this time that I'm a socialist. And I was fully convinced that to be a Republican and be a Christian is absolutely incongruous. Here's why. You Republicans, greedy prophets. You know what you lousy folks do? You literally, if you have a piece of farmland and you don't want someone to hunt pheasant or hunt on it, you post a sign: no hunting, private property. I used to look at the word private property and almost throw up. It sounded so negative to me. So, we, as the market model, we have to defend private property, we have to defend competition, we have to defend greed, we have to defend, you know, and where on socialism, here's what you get to defend: fairness, equality. We're all equal. Oh, this is so beautiful. We're all a community. We're all in this together. Everybody's business. Everybody's. So we don't all have to run to our home. It's all of our homes. You know, when I'm trying to think of the senator from South Dakota that ran for president of the United States in 1970, George McGovern. When George McGovern ran for president in 1972, and I'm at the height of my socialism nutcaseism, George McGovern literally ran on the platform that he was going to take $1,000 from everybody above the median level of income and give that $1,000 to everybody below the median level of income. And since Mandy and I were one of the belowers, again, a terrific idea to take your money and give it to me. It's a great idea. I taught at 3 universities, and the sociology department was always very good at getting government money to study everything from A to Z. And one time I said to the chairman of the Department of Economics, Department of Sociology, I said, Marty, if we would just give to the poor all the money that you guys spend studying the poor would be rich. And Marty says, yeah, I know, but what about us? See, there is the problem. What about us? So inevitably, when you have free money floating out here, everybody will seek to get their particular share of what they seem to be their share. and they will move strong. It's so the point there is socialism works perfect in books. Socialism works perfect on paper. Socialism works perfect to touch your heart. And that's great. It just cannot be made to work in practice. Economists call this tragedy of the commons. What's the tragedy of the commons? The minute things are commonly owned, like the whales swimming through the ocean, no one owns them, therefore no one manages them, therefore if you don't go ahead and kill the whale, you will. And therefore, we kill them all. There's no mechanism by which not. So that's called the tragedy of the commons. And so the tragedy of the commons in both Russia, Soviet Union, and China is, I guess they thought, collectivized agriculture. We're all in this together. No one owns anything. And when no one owns anything, no one manages anything either. You don't have any problem with chickens and cows becoming extinct. Why? Because farmers fence them and corral them and manage the herd. They have great self-interest to manage the herd. But put polar bear or whale or anything else under the commons and the whole thing goes up in smoke. So as we think of this election then, we have now the opportunity to begin building the blocks for a market-driven economy. In a market-driven economy, it means way less government. And so we either do it the way Governor Christie is coming to town this next week. He'll be speaking at the Goldwater Institute. And Governor Christie has saying, the game is over. This is a revolution. This is unsustainable, what America is doing. I have no control over America, but I do have some control over my state. No, no, we're not going to build a $14 billion tunnel under the Hudson River. I'm not going to commit New Jersey taxpayers to the biggest boondoggle that you can ever imagine. No, no, it's a new game, Governor Christie says. It's a new game. See, so we do have some people say, no, there's a revolution now going on. The revolution has begun. Governor Christie gets it. The governor of Virginia says, no, 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 no. We're not going to spend this much on government. We are going to cut everything we do in government to 2007 levels. Whatever. So now you're all the state employees. You're all the heads of these various departments in the state of Virginia. And I'm the governor, and I'm speaking to you. All of you, figure out how to take your departments back to 2007 spending and 2007 employment levels. Figure it out. I'm not going to do that for you. Okay? The governor of Indiana says what we're going to do is we're going to cut government spending. You're not going to leave, are you? Okay. Because she gets to ask the first question today. I've already promised her, so you come back. We'll see. Okay. The governor of Indiana says, no, what we're going to do is we're going to cut a government salaries by 10% and freeze benefits until the ship of state gets righted in the state of Indiana. I tell you, when you elect a candidate like for governor, Mark Rubio, is he governor or senator? Senator. Senator Rubio in Florida. It is so necessary because our type, Scottsdale Bible Church type, we're by and large a fairly white church. And when you do that, sometimes you do not have near the sensitivity that you should have towards Hispanics, towards blacks, and towards a lot of other people. But I tell you, even with great, great effort, the market side only picked up 25% of the Hispanic vote. So the Hispanic vote, by and large, goes this way. And the black vote, by and large, goes this way. And people who really, really, really care about the poor, their vote seems to go this way. So it seemed to me that we've got to figure out what we are doing wrong, why we are found so very, very repulsive to the black vote, to the Hispanic vote. Oh, by the way, to young people's vote. That's another one. When you're young, just like when I was 20 years old and 22 years old, I was a raving socialist. It was so much fun. And all my Christian friends who were not just would look at me and begin to shake all over. And that was fun. How could you be so wrong and I could be so right? I just loved it. But anyway, the young vote, invariably this vote is going to be the most dreamy, the most utopian. This will be the vote that there's no end to the do-gooders will do that with other people's money. And since young people don't have much money, they just love to do lots of good with other people's money. See, plus, you're going to find more people that are young that are definitely pro-choice on abortion. When you're young, it's just natural that you have an affinity for your fellow brothers and sisters, and they are the ones that are all in, they have in children and all the rest stage as compared to a lot of us oldsters. But the older you get, the more that issue comes into view. So it's young, it's Hispanic, it's black, and I tell you what, we have a big, big job to do. But back to Mark Rubio. Oh, my heavens. He's electric. Now, do we want someone electric? Maybe not. We've already got somebody that's electric. Maybe not. But I tell you what. People buy into more enthusiasm rather than less enthusiasm. People seem to buy into more literacy than to less literacy. And you take Mark Rubio and you put him next to George W. And God bless George W.'s soul. He wrote a great book. He's been doing a great job throughout the country. And notice how he's avoiding anything criticizing his successor. So, you know, Bush is showing great class, great class. But one once again is reminded that he's not... That you say it for me. I'm trying to imitate Bush. I didn't do a very good job. He's not as quick with an English language as most people would prefer. And Mark Rubio is like a snap. So it's not just Mark Rubio. But to be honest with you, we've got a whole stable of very, very competent people. I mean, anybody that knows Paul Ante in Minnesota and been around him is impressed. Anyone that knows Bob Thune from South Dakota is quite impressed. If you haven't met Paul Ryan yet from the state of Wisconsin, you're in for a treat. If you haven't got to spend maybe a little time with Mark Rubio down there, which none of us really have because he's brand new, but my gracious, gracious, beautiful family of four. They're so darn cute. But anyway, that's neat. We have the Governor Christie's of New Jersey and the Governor of Virginia and the Governor of Indiana kind of leading the way as to what this might look like. And that's not yet to name a couple of the older hands. What I mean by older hands, I'll name Sarah Palin. She's only been around 2 or 3 years, but my goodness, what an impact Sarah Palin makes. Mitt Romney, you know, I can't tell you what courage it took for Dr. Wayne Grudem to stand in front of his fellow evangelicals throughout this country and throughout this world and said, no, I am going to support Mitt Romney for president. This is not to say that I like his religion. I don't particularly care for the religion. Don't get me wrong. But we're not voting for the head of the church. We're not voting for the Pope. We're not voting for this. And Wayne then would say, My main concern is the Supreme Court. There's not a dime's worth of difference of whom I would nominate and get elected to the Supreme Court than what Mitt Romney wants for the Supreme Court. I've just got to tell you. Mitt Romney is for lower taxes. I'm for lower taxes. Mitt Romney is for less government. I'm for less government. Mitt Romney is against cap and trade. I'm against cap and trade. Mitt Romney is against this god-awful, well, maybe he isn't. Now, that's one. So we have to stop and pause. He was a good governor of Massachusetts. But to be quite honest with you, he tried to foist on to the state of Massachusetts a national healthcare system. And so now we're getting some experience with that Massachusetts system. So for a lot of conservatives like yourself, you're a little bit uncomfortable perhaps with the LDS part of it, but you're quite uncomfortable with the healthcare part of it. So for you, you would say, draw the line, scratch Mitt Romney. Okay, fine. Do whatever you're going to do. Scratch Mitt Romney. I was trying to think of one other candidate. Sarah Palin, Mitch Romney, Huckabee, very interesting guy. Huckabee keeps insisting that he's not going to run, and he better stop insisting, because you really have to raise tens, hundreds of millions of dollars early on. And I think he's having so much fun playing his guitar on TV and having everybody fall in love with him that I'm not so sure he wants to walk away from it. Only to say, there will be all kinds of candidates that are very, very articulate, very, very capable of handling the free market side, the market solution. So, now, let me stop. And let's talk about what you want to talk about. And your first question is QE2, quantitative easing. They're going to do it again.
Okay, but they said they were not. Geithner said he was not going to do it. It was not going to happen.
He did?
Yeah,
Geithner did. In the last day or two?
No, maybe 6 months ago, 4 months ago. Okay. So then Bernanke comes on the scene.
And did it anyway.
And he said he's doing it. The rest of the world doesn't like it. So what I don't understand is, how can we monetize our own debt? I mean, we sold these bonds and we went into debt to do it. Now we're buying them back. That's monetizing, right?
Yes.
Monetizing the debt. Okay, so how does that work?
That whole quantitative easing number two has to be put in the context, once again, of the market model, the political model. Understand that Alan Greenspan, Tom Geithner, Ben Bernanke, these are the smart guys. These are the guys that get to run the machine. These are the guys that Bernanke feels now that he can pull $600 billion out of the sky and get it out there. And that's why it says quantitative easing, more money. These folks do not get it. These folks do not get it. Let me tell you, when Alan Greenspan and Ben Bernanke can do all this pouring money into the economy, monetizing the deficit, as they say, add it to the national debt, but actually create the currency so it's out there, and create bubbles right in front of our eyes, building 5 million too many homes right in front of our eyes, allowing oil prices to go to $145 a barrel, steel to go to $1,300 a metric ton, to have the price of corn go from $2.50 a bushel to $8.50 a bushel. Bubbles, 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 thousands, thousands, millions of bubbles, and have Alan Greenspan look out into space and I don't see any bubbles. Alan Greenspan, you ought to have your butt kicked over the moon. But see, they don't get it. And they don't get it because they get to run the machine. And then you have to pick up the taxes of running that machine and the aftermath of running the machine. So this side of the fence, market people say this, that strong economies are not built with weak currencies. It's not built with weak currencies. But when you do quantitative easing, you're adding even more money into this and destroying the value of the dollar even more and making the dollar even go down further. Where is all this pressure coming from? This pressure is coming from exporters. Exporters like a dollar that goes to zero. Exporters like it when the dollar falls. Because when the dollar falls, it makes our exports even more attractive. Guess who is right back up to 2007 levels as we speak? Big American exporters. That's who. We're back. There's no recession. There's no depression. Are you kidding me? In 2007, we had the biggest numbers that we've ever had in the history of America, and we're back up to those big numbers again. They're in great shape. Well, you keep driving the dollar into the ground, making our exports. So now, on another sense, I'm definitely on Caterpillar's side when they're complaining about the health care bill, but you don't think Caterpillar is elated with this low dollar? You don't think that Intel is elated with this low dollar? You don't think all the major manufacturing exporters are elated with this low dollar? They love this low dollar. Now, though, now you back off and you say, but can a strong economy be built on a weak dollar? Because when you do this quantitative easing, it just continues to drive the dollar into the ground. Absolutely, unequivocally not. So what do we have to do? We've got to look at the federal funds rate averaged 4% over 40 years. 3, 4, 5%. It averaged 4%. You know the federal funds rate now is? It's almost zero. Zero. And he's doing quantitative easing when it's already at zero. That zero is the wrong signal. That zero is the wrong signal. It was that crazy kind of signal that made 1,000 teenage girls in San Francisco buy million-dollar homes. It was that kind of signal that the whole thing goes wacky. This is nuts. It just emphasizes one little piece of your economy. Now let's understand where our... So who's getting battered? Who's getting killed? Obviously the little guy. Obviously the corner entrepreneur. Obviously the small businessman. Absolutely getting killed. Now let's understand a little bit of why this is happening. This government easing and all has forced people to say, you know what, I'm not going to save. I'm not going to save any money. You can't make any money anyway. They're not going to pay any interest. And certainly I'm not going to put my money in dollars. They're just driving the dollar down. So for a while we thought it was going to be in our housing. That's going to be where our savings is going to be, in our housing. But then the housing market poofs. And it poofs because of government policy. It was government policy that called for the Community Reinvestment Act and moving home ownership to 70%. And there's not 70% of America can own their own home. There's not 70% of America can afford it. We did it anyway. How did we do that? We backed all those government loans with Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. So we get in a situation where we've got $2.5 trillion of subprime mortgages guaranteed by government. And so no wonder, what are people going to do? If I put a cat in a box with a mouse, what's the cat going to do to the mouse? Kill it, kill it. Now, you blame the cat if you want to. What do you think the cat was going to do? You think the cat's going to go in and make nice with the mouse? What do you think bankers do? They loan. What do you think builders do? They pound nails. What do you think entrepreneurs do? They try to make profits. And if they go out trying to do that and then you blame them? No, government built this box. They build it. And now we're just and now we have to play in it. And sooner than not, we've got to come to our head. This quantitative easing. I sure wish Geithner could have been right. I wish he could have been right that we wouldn't have, but they've done it to us. They're passing it as we speak, they've passed it. There's going to be quantitative easing. Another $600 billion of poor out. Now, eventually, where's this all going to end? It's going to end up in an inflation like there's no tomorrow. Has to. Where else? The only reason it's not inflation now is because we're in a deflation economy. And things, we're running 65% capacity, so there's so much room to move. So, bad mistake. Slowly, we've got to get the federal funds rate up and get life back to normal so that the market can decide where resources could go, not the president of the United States decided. What's your question?
Part of this question, what do you mean we're passing it? I didn't get the feeling anybody was voting.
We don't get to vote on that. The Federal Reserve Board makes that decision. They get together with the 10 governors of the Federal Reserve, and there's only one reserve governor that says this is insanity, and that's the reserve governor. Henning is his name, and he's from Kansas City, and he's voting against. So last time, the vote on this quantitative, 9-1. 9-1 because they again get to run it. They get to be the operatives. They get to be so powerful that they can decide what happens to this economy. It's top-down command and control all over again.
I hate to sound like a complete ignoramus, but how did they get in that position? How did these people get there?
We decided that we will go off the gold standard. We decided that we're going to let smart people decide about how much money that they should add into the economy every week and every month. And we're not going to let some external number like how much gold you hold as to determine that. You're really beginning to see many, many intellectuals saying, we've got to bring gold back into the picture. And you're going to increasingly see that. But right now, it is in the FDIC's hands, and mainly the chairman has enormous power, and his name is Bernanke. Yes, was there a hand back here? Oh, back, I'm sorry.
Hi. What I understand is with the dollar deflation, eventually we could get to a dollar that's worth nothing. And is that true, and what do we as individuals do about that?
There's not much we as individuals can do, but governments always make this choice. Argentina destroyed itself three times in the 20th century by inflating. See, the nice thing about inflating, the government has all this debt now. The government has been collecting Social Security checks from Americans for the last 60 years. They've not put one dime into an account. The second they get it, they spend it. The second they get it, so now we have the situation where right this minute, every day, 10,000 people walking up to the Social Security window, every day now for the next 20 years, every day, 10,000 people saying, no more government am I writing checks to you. You're now going to write checks to me, Social Security. 2 or 3 years from now, see, it's the greatest Ponzi scheme that ever was. Social Security is the greatest Ponzi scheme that ever was. They didn't put that away in a trust fund. It's gone. So now what is the choice? To either raise taxes until it blows us all out of the water or inflate the currency. By inflation, in other words, you pay back then all of this nonsense with debauched dollars. So let's go ahead, quantitative easing, more easing. Let's now have lots of inflation, and now government pays back some of this with debauched dollars. Do you see? That's why they're going to do it. And they've always done it. Inflation has destroyed more countries than anything else. They're going to do that again. They're in the process of doing that again. So that's why they do it, because it's the only way they can pay back the debt. The only way you can make good on the $15 trillion of unfunded liabilities and Social Security is to pay it back with debauched dollars. The way you pay it back, debauch them, is add more and make each one worth less. It's called inflation. The only way you can get out of this is through inflation. Government has no other way. So that's going to be an interesting question. It's not all over, folks. Don't go home and slit your wrists today. Don't slit your wrists, because our public debt is only 85% of our GDP. It ranged from 30 to 50% of our GDP over the last 40 years. Now it's 85. In another year, it'll be 100%. And another 3 years at this rate. This year, the federal government will take in less than $2.2 trillion of revenue and will spend $3.6 trillion. That's like you making $50,000 and spending $85,000. You make $50,000 and you spend $85,000. You can only do that so long. That is unsustainable. You making $50,000 and spending $85,000 is unsustainable. What we're doing is unsustainable. That's why this election is so important. That's why economic literacy is so important. And it's going to be interesting how people are going to fight. I mean, is there any choice but to raise the retirement age from 65 to 66 to 67 over a period of 10, 20, 30 years? I don't think there's a choice. I think we have. And yet, are we going to just hang on and say, to heck with it? No. You're not going to do that to me. You're not going to do that to me. Blah, blah, blah. So there's a lot of things that we're all going to cling. We're going to cling. But, or are we to the point that frog in the pothole couldn't get out? But he says, get out. I can't. He went to the party, saw his frog at the party, says, I thought you said you couldn't get out of the pothole. And the frog says, I couldn't, but I looked out and a truck was coming and I had to. Well, the truck's coming. We're now at 85% of the GDP in national debt. We're going to close in on 100%. I had to. I couldn't. No. You have to. That's what we call what's going on starting last Tuesday. This is a revolution. This is a big change. This is, we're going to make some things happen. A question.
Off the monetary issue, back to the health insurance. And I couldn't agree with you more about the dislike of the what was shoved down our throats. But the question I have relates to the fact that insurance companies, if you're, say, 55, 60 years old, and you've ever had it's anything like a hangnail, if you apply as an individual for health insurance, they won't give it to you. And I'm not sure how we overcome
that. No insurance company will give it to you, or most won't?
Well, we went through it. And
okay.
My wife applied to several, and they said no.
Yeah.
In Arizona, fortunately, you have portability. So if you've had insurance and you go without it, you've got a 90-day period. And they have to, if they're selling insurance in the state, they have to sell it to you, but they can charge 3 or 4 times more. Yeah. So the basic issue and problem I see that's out there is that insurance companies don't want to insure people that need insurance. And I'm wondering, does it make any sense to do a public utility? Like
yes,
the
yes,
electricity
yes, yes.
companies?
They don't want to do that because obviously that's very, very costly. But what we're going to have to do is find a number of private insurance companies that begin to put big risk pools together by which most of those people then can get in. They'll pay a pretty good price, but at least it's available to them. There's been no incentive to this point to form those kind of pools. You say some kind of a public utility, I'd like to call it some kind of a private utility, where you can make the pool so big that you can make some of this, what you just talked about, doable. Well, I think where there...
Like a public utility where you limit on...
I'm just going to say no, but come up here afterwards, and we'll talk how we might do that. Because if I say yes, it's like saying yes to TARP just once. And you say yes to TARP, and you've said yes to TARP. And TARP is precisely what blows everything up. One more question. We're having so much fun.
with the Federal Reserve, it is by far the largest holder of government debt, far larger than China. Last I knew, the Federal Reserve, and this was a couple of years ago, had about $6.5 trillion worth of government bonds. So the government pays interest on those bonds, and they pay that interest money back to the Federal Reserve. What does the Federal Reserve do with the funds that it gets from the government in interest payments?
It accumulates it. It does things like buy back bonds. It does things like monetize deficits. It does all kinds of evil things. That's my word, evil. All kinds of interesting things. Well, we've got another church service coming up. Is Pastor Darrell up today? He's up. So if some of you, it's been a while since you've heard Pastor Darrell, I've got to throw a good word in for Darrell. Every summer, we do a leadership conference, and Wayne Grudem gets to speak for a half a day, and I get to speak for a half a day, and Darrell Delisay gets to speak for half a day. 4 years running, who has the best ratings by far? It's like Wayne and I don't even exist. You got it. Darrell Delisay. So if you haven't enjoyed him recently, go do it here at the 11 o'clock hour. Thank you very much. Oh, by the way, wait. I did bring a few more. I have a dear friend that's going to have, these are gifts. Throw in $2, $5, $10 on my book called It's Tea Time Again. I wrote it in 1994, and I have yet to sell one copy. And I'm not going to sell one either. This is just a gift that you're going to throw in for those of you that want to get up. They'll be back at the back table. Again, we've done this for the Ludwigs a couple times. Thank you.